calling this evening's focus Thinning the Veil of Me. Thinning the Veil of Me. It assumes that there is a veil of who I think I am between me and whatever you want to call the other side. Reality, the true nature of myself, or the true nature of it all. But we're going to take a look at thinning that veil, which is the process that we're all involved in. The poet David White talks about getting tired of myself, of getting tired of himself. And that he came to a place in the middle of his life where he said, I think we all have to arrange to get very tired of ourselves in order to move on beyond the story of me that we all have. We spend a lot of time shoring up the story of me and defending it, making sure that it doesn't have any gaps or holes in it, the story of who I am. Probably in the service of decreasing anxiety that might just show up if I don't have that full confidence that this is who I am. If I'm not this, then what am I? Or who am I? So I spend that time and energy recreating and solidifying the sense of who I am. Without the story of me, I can feel empty and scared, or both. So we continue to do what John Travis calls making up the story, making up the movie, that we're all like producers of a movie. The movie of me, in which I'm the producer and director and star, and I create the movie, and then as I'm creating it, I run around into the audience and look at it, and I get taken in, and I believe that it's real. I see the story, and I, just like we do in the movies, if it's a good movie, we get a sense that it's real. We're really there. We want to be there with that person or that situation. So we continually create this movie of ourselves and run around and get in the audience and look at it and give it credibility. It's a form of attachment. Big surprise. Probably one of the strongest forms of attachment. And it starts when we're very, very tiny. We're born into a world. We're born into a family and a culture. And we begin to learn the very basic things. You are a child. You are a little boy or a little girl. You are so-and-so's brother, so-and-so's sister. This is who you are. And that happens right away. It gets more involved in you are a Buddhist, or you are a Christian, or you are white, or you are Latin American, or, you know, they're just, the possibilities are endless. But we get this conditioning very early, and these things are real in the sense that this is how we operate in the world. It's not that that's unreal or even undesirable, but that it is so deeply, deeply conditioned. That's what we're looking at, is the depth of the conditioning of all those things. Ram Dass talks a lot about being somebody and gradually learning to be nobody. But we have to learn that we're somebody before we can begin to be nobody. In other words, the development of the ego in order to function in the world is what we, that has to happen first. And when that is, clear and stable, then it becomes easier to begin to watch that dissolve and to become nobody. He says, you were told you were somebody because you were raised by people who thought they were somebody. But that at some point, and probably for different, maybe for different reasons or in different circumstances or to different degrees for the people in here, there has been some inkling or some call or some inclination that you want to go into nobody training. So that's what we're doing here. We're in nobody training. You can't rush nobody training. It can't be pushed. The world, at least my experience is that the world will constantly show me where I'm not. Okay. If I get ahead of myself, if I think I'm farther along on that path than I am, bam. I had a wonderful example of that about a week ago. I live in a condo development, and I work with the Homeowners Association. And I was asked by the board to write an extended email message, a kind of a letter, which I agreed to do. And I got very caught up in it, in terms of the ego, on two fronts that I'll tell you about, but I didn't realize it at the time. I just thought I was writing a message. And I did. One thing that I got caught up in was having some degree of skill at putting together some coherent thoughts. And, you know, looking at it and saying, that's a fine message, you know, and sending it out. I saw that only after it was done. And the other piece was I became very caught up in the position that I didn't realize that I had so taken a position that I had come down heavily on one side of an issue, and I didn't even realize it until it was pointed out to me that this was not a balanced message. And then I reread it and I thought, oh my goodness, it wasn't. So it's just two different ways that I got caught up in that I was brought to the awareness of where I was not. The ego got involved. I was somebody in both of those examples. Being right. I've since looked at the other sides of this issue and have almost done a 180. But at least have become much more aware that there are different sides to this issue. Another example, almost on the same day, was that of getting irritated at my son in the morning. He was on his way to work, and I knew he didn't have time, and so I didn't speak about that at that time. But I didn't want to stuff it, and so I found myself in the position of I have kind of a hard time staying mad, and especially at this person, at this young man. So I had to, later in the day, keep going back and kind of dredging up. Now, what was it I was mad about this morning? And it's like a statement of how inconsequential it was that I had to go into the past to pull up what it was, so that I could then speak about it. I was pretty invested in that one too. So we can certainly consider some of these defenses or ways of like I would say, solidifying this sense of who we are. Cynicism works for a lot of people to cover pain. You can feel that in yourself sometimes. You may have felt that in yourself over the past week watching what's happening in Washington. A little bit of cynicism can creep in to cover the pain of the sadness of it all. Anger makes a good cover for vulnerability because it makes us feel like we're more powerful maybe than we are, that we do have some control. When we are in this stance of me, of this is who I am, if you can imagine life as being a river, and one option is to flow with the river. But when I am in me, when I'm recreating the story of me, I'm grabbing onto branches as I go down the river. This one. Well, if not that one, this one. Well, if not that one, this one. This is who I am, rather than simply flowing with it the way it is. There's a sense of grasping. No surprise. So who I am not is a big list. I am not my stuff. That's probably the first thing to notice, is that I am not my stuff. I'm not my money, however large that stash is or small. That's not who I am. I'm not my body. That's a little bit harder because we have a whole lot of identification with the body. But I am not the body. I'm not my thoughts. That's one that we really work on here in this practice. I am not my thoughts. It's so amazing when you begin to see a thought go by and realize that it isn't you. That it's just, there went that one. There goes another one. That it's not me. It's so freeing. I'm not my emotions. They're more subtle and sometimes can stay longer than a thought. But that's still not who I am. They come and they go. They have a beginning and a middle and an end. I am not my roles. I am not myself and my image of myself. I was aware just an hour ago when I was asking Maxine about leaving, and I was aware of thanking you for the music, which is a role, which doesn't even touch the being that's there. And I thought, what an inadvertent discount, you know, of the being to identify someone with a role. We do that all the time. With ourselves as well as other people. We are not our talents and skills. We have learned how to do certain things, and most of us have learned certain things quite well. And there's nothing wrong with that, and it sure helps us to move around in the world. But that's not who I am. It's not who you are. I am not my education and credentials. Sorry. and when you love to go to school and you work very hard to master something, to master a field or an area. Again, nothing wrong with that. It's great. It's part of living in the world. It just isn't who you are. We're not our memories and our plans, which are mostly thoughts, as you consider that. We're not our memories and plans. Here's another painful one. We're not our opinions. Ooh. Opinions are basically thoughts, usually with an emotional component to them, because we're so right. But they come and go. We're not our opinions. were not our cultural or religious aspects. Those are things that we were usually either born into or have chosen because of a certain affinity, but it's still not who we are. Goodness, what's left? So another kind of face of this business of me and identifying is that of aversion, is the flip side, which rather than saying, this is what I am, and holding that tightly, is a sense of, I'm not that. Whatever I am, I'm not that. You know, I'm not like certain persons in Congress. You know, surely that's not me. That's them. Okay, we get this sense of, again, of taking a stance and identifying with it in an aversive way in deciding what I'm not. We're rebelling in a way. I have an ongoing attachment aversion. Mostly attachment, I think, in that I love puzzles. I love to do puzzles, always have. And historically, it was jigsaw puzzles. It's one of the only things that will keep me up late. I won't go to bed because the next piece has got to go in. You know, but that piece doesn't do it. It's the piece after that that's going to do it. So it's this reaching out and grasping for that next piece of the puzzle that's going to do it. There's really a compulsive and addictive quality to that that I have felt so often. It's not so much jigsaw puzzles anymore, partly because I don't have a lot of space. Then I went through a period where it was crossword puzzles. To do that, I had to get past the aversion to being like my mother. But when I finally decided that I wouldn't turn into my mother if I liked crossword puzzles, I started doing crossword puzzles like crazy. And I collect them out of the paper, and I have stacks of crosswords. Again, I could feel the reaching out. I could feel the addictive quality of that. And there was almost a sense of it getting out of control. You know, is this thing going to take me over? And I had to, the process that I had was involved in was one of a little bit of this, a little bit of, now relax, it's okay. You can do some crossword puzzles. You can stop anytime you want to stop. So that there came a time when that urge to keep doing them tapered off. And now I can do crossword puzzles and I enjoy it, but I don't just always do them. Now, thanks to modern technology, I've discovered spider solitaire, the intermediate level. And you notice the status there, being at the intermediate level. And there's something about this that just one more hand and I can get it, you know. So this is my journey with puzzles. And again, the place where I am right now is I'm about to peak with that. I'm about to get comfortable with the fact that I love doing this and that it's okay and that it won't take over my life. So there's a whew that comes with that, that, oh yeah, this is not who I am. Good thing I don't play blackjack. So, there's this, that's the process of seeing this attachment and kind of softening around it, not getting freaked out about it, and coming to understand that it's no big deal. It's not who I am, but neither do I have to be afraid of it. That I can watch it, which is where this practice comes in, that I can build an awareness of it, and I can watch it, and I can see myself reach for it, or push it away, whichever it is. And I can watch that process of softening that will take place, that with attention brought to it will take place. It's organic. It's built into the nature of this practice. Nisargadatta, one of the Indian masters, says, empty yourself completely. Give up all ideas about yourself and simply be. Stop making use of your mind and see what happens. Do this one thing thoroughly. That is all. Nisargadatta. I was at Wild and Woolly and found a video of him. Took it home to watch it and was stunned to see that he's a chain smoker. Which didn't fit with my notion of this Indian master, but nevertheless, these are his wise words. Gil Fronsdale says, as we go along, we draw in our shadow from the external world. What we need to learn or purify, we draw in our shadow. And the suggestion sometimes is to think of these aspects, these roles, or these aspects that we call me, as coming and going, as being like weather, and holding them in the larger context of climate. So that it gives them a more spacious field in which to not be so important. They don't take up so much of ourselves. They're all temporary and relative. They have beginning and middle and end. A Zen saying, above the saddle, no rider. Below the saddle, no horse. A wonderful view of emptiness. So the place where this practice comes into this business of me and how I identify the story of me. This practice hastens the organic shedding or thinning of the veil of me. It makes it more likely. I don't know that we're ever going to get completely beyond who I think I am, who you think you are. But the process is one of it thinning, of it softening, of not holding it so tightly. And this practice helps us to do that because it's a practice of watching, of being present and bringing this intricate quality of attention to what's happening right now so that we can see it more clearly, the meaning of Vipassana. We begin to see our true nature, which is way beyond the story, as these obstacles thin and fall away. Another thing that begins to happen is we develop compassion for our addictive nature, compassion for the depth of our conditioning and our attachments. And rather than judging ourselves, just watching it and saying, wow, you know, I'm really attached to that one. That one must really go deep. So developing a compassion for ourselves. On the way, we may take this detour that is known as becoming Buddhist, okay? That can become, or becoming a meditator, that this can become just one more attachment, just something else that I add to the movie of me. And again, just like everything else, that has to be, ultimately, we let go of that. Jack Kornfield says, the true path to liberation is to let go of everything, even the states and fruits of practice themselves, and to open to that which is beyond all identity. Eventually, even the practice, even the path goes. Some teachers talk about this practice taking us to the other shore, and when you get to the other shore, you don't hang on to the raft. You know, you let it go. You let it go. So some of the ways in which this is likely to show up in your lives as you go along and loosen these chains or thin this veil of the story of me. You begin to take things not so personally. Nothing is really personal. And you begin to see that, and the feeling of taking things personally begins to soften and to disappear. We don't take our thoughts for reality so much. We don't take ourselves so seriously. Our delusional periods, and we do have them, are shorter and lighter. You know, it's not that they just completely evaporate, but they're shorter. You can say, oh, I really was doing that. And they're lighter. You can sometimes see through them even while they're happening. It's easier to access the larger view, the view of holding everything in this bigger space. There's a greater tolerance to hosting both the positive and the negative mind states without feeling like we're going to get lost in them. Your tolerance, your ability to hold these negative or positive, which can be equally as seductive at least, of holding those mind states and seeing them as mind states and not getting lost in them. Or if you get lost in them, finding it sooner. That tolerance for that grows and the judgment decreases and it's, oh, there I went again. And fear and anxiety decrease greatly in general. I think this was from Pema Chodron. She talks about easing the burden of maintaining our own private happiness. Easing the burden of maintaining our own private happiness by doing Tonglen practice. The Tonglen practice is a wonderful way to do that. This is from Wu Wei Wu, very old saying. Why are you so unhappy? Because 99.9% of what you think and everything you do is for yourself, and there isn't one. It's one way of describing the source of unhappiness. This was a poem by William Stafford called The Way It Is. There is a thread you follow. It goes among things that change, but it doesn't change. People wonder about what you are pursuing. And you have to explain about the thread, but it's hard for others to see. While you hold it, you can't get lost. Tragedies happen. People get hurt. And you suffer and get old. Nothing you do can stop time's unfolding. You don't ever let go of the thread. Though your destination is not clear, you can trust the promise of this opening. Unfurl yourself into the grace of beginning that is at one with your life's desire. Awaken your spirit to adventure. Hold nothing back. Learn to find ease in risk. Soon you will be home in a new rhythm, for your soul senses the world that awaits you. A couple of pieces from Gangaji. If you will stop trying to find yourself in some definition, in an instant of true and sincere self-inquiry, the indefinable spaciousness of consciousness reveals itself as who you are. The indefinable spaciousness of consciousness reveals itself as who you are. And to end this one, also from Gangaji. It is possible for you to discover more deeply the force, the power, the grace that moves your life. You have the choice to surrender your thoughts, your emotions, your habits, and your ideas to the grace that is calling you home. I am here to support that grace in you. I am here to support that grace in you.